But I think from the point of view of fact, that as I understand both Dante and Williams, and he is extremely important, an integral part of life, because that's true of a lot of things. But that love is not something that you are dealing with as a projection. It is a fact of experience, of relationship that happens to you in a kind of an actuality that even precludes an imaginative interpretation of it. Now, I don't know if that explains what he means. You see, what he means when he talks about know thyself of the Greek as know love of the Christian, he goes really back to Socrates when he said that the important thing for all knowledge was to know yourself, and most of us can't know that. I mean, if we could only know ourselves, we would really be at the beginning of all education. And that was that was his big criterion. The Christian, Williams says, is no love. Now, love to Williams was the love of Christ. I mean, that's who love is in its fullest form and its most factual form. And he says, both in the end were one. Well, now that means that when you finally get to the point of knowing yourself completely, you also know that you have to, that you are loved, and that the fact of love, Christ, is part of your knowing of yourself. This is something that I don't believe it was impossible for man to know himself in the world except first after some mode of knowledge, some art of discovery. The most perfect, since the most intimate and intelligent art was pure love. Now, the way in which this kind of knowledge of love for most people, we don't learn to know Christ as, you know, wow, I love Christ. But we know love by loving the relationship of love with another person, whether it's a parent or a friend or a husband or whatever, you know, whatever it is. That you know love in that way. And that's why he says that the most intimate, intelligent art was pure love. The approach by love was the approach to fact. To love anything but fact was not love. And by that, I think you have to remember that he's thinking about this in the connection of the relationship of all these characters, that the grandmother and Pauline and Peter and Wentworth and Adela and all these people are related to love in some way or another. Actually, you see, Wentworth is not related to love in any way except a love for himself. And that kind of thing is not the pure love that is being referred to here. You see what I mean? That the other, like Stanhope and Pauline and the grandmother, for instance, are all related to the love that Williams is talking about here, that is the actual love that is in God in Christ and that is known to us in another person in a small way. That's the way we discover it the first time. But the great discovery, when we know ourselves and love, is when we discover it in Christ. And this is when he says it's more mathematical, he means that it is something that is actually, it's almost tangible in terms of its being able to work it out. It's that kind of a fact. He doesn't want it to be understood as some idea or abstraction. You see what I mean? He wants it to be something that is pinned down to a concrete, we usually think of math or arithmetic as being fairly concrete, although it can go into the realm of theorem and ideas, particularly when you go into the advanced end of it.
So is it then, love is not an ideal? It's
no, it's not an ideal. It's never.
Like, well, Kierkegaard works on it saying love is shown by its fruit.
Yeah.
It's the action.
It's the action, and it's a concretion. It's never an abstraction.
Okay.
You never talk about love as being something out here.
Well, it just sort of emphasizing again that Christ is real. He's not
It's not idealism. In philosophy, idealism is something that you think of idealism as being, you know, well, he's an idealistic person. But idealism in philosophy is when you deal in abstractions that are out here someplace, not something that is actual and within the realm of the immediate fact. And that's why he uses the term fact, to really sort of knock you out. And he uses it again and again with Wentworth, that the agony of facts bothers Wentworth. And so he rejects them. And this is where, and that's because the other is also a fact. You see, the other person, or the other persons, and we have to deal with them. They are facts, and you have to deal with them. And you want to reject them because you want to deal with only this fantasy world that Wentworth is in. And we all get that way. I mean, it's not, we don't go that far as Wentworth did. But we do have a tendency to want to gloss things over and not face the facts as they are, as people always tell us to do.
Except they usually point to their own facts.
Yeah, well, that's true, too. we did talk about Lily and Lilith yesterday, about how when she, on page 74 there, when you were back in that chapter, the vision of death, that Pauline was standing there, and the two neared each other, it's the bottom of the page, the gate still between them, and began to talk. No more hurt, no more pain, no more but dreams, a voice said. I mean, this is very much like what she says to Wentworth. And you remember that in this Return to Eden, one of the things that ticks Wentworth off is the article he reads in the paper about Aston Moffat, you know, that he's getting a knighthood. And one of the one point I wanted to bring out there, because I think it's I don't know if I we talked about it yesterday, page 80, where he talks about his eyes. He stood irritably still, and then he saw bursting honors and a smaller headline, Knighthood for Historian. And then farther down, his puppet eyes stared. They found the item by the name in black type for their convenience, Aston Moffat. And then it says, this is where the temptation comes again. Mm-hmm. It was presented to him at once and clearly an opportunity for joy. You find it? Page 80, mm-hmm. Middle of the page. Casual, accidental joy, but joy, you know. If he could not manage joy, at least he might have managed the intention of joy, or if that also were too much, an effort towards the intention of joy. The infinity of grace could have been contented and invoked by a mere mental refusal of anything but such an effort. He knew his duty. He was no fool. He knew that the fantastic recognition would please and amuse the innocent soul of Sir Aston, not so much for himself as in some unselfish way for the honor of history. I think that is important because, well, for many reasons, but the one thing I think is that the infinity of grace could have been contented with even just the slightest movement. You know, we always think that God is going to be just as hard-boiled as we are with other people and ourselves. And I think Williams is so, it's just really great gospel here. The infinity of grace would have been satisfied even if there was just the slightest twinge of movement in the direction of something larger than himself for Wentworth. Just a little, just if he could have said to himself, oh, I wish I could be glad about this. But he couldn't even say that, you see. I mean, even a little, something that you can hardly see.
But maybe the thing with this with Wentworth, you know, is that I feel like I've done that too, you know, and yet still been reached somehow beyond that.
Yeah.
You know, it's just too bad that it's so final for Wentworth.
Well, yes, but maybe, you see, the thing about Wentworth,
about novels. Too.
Well, the thing is that this is, you've got to remember that Wentworth, you're looking at a man over a long period of a whole a whole lifetime of refusals. I mean, he's not a youngster. And he's you know, he's been rejecting and rejecting, and even at the very most closest to the end, he still is given opportunities to repent. And we wouldn't say that they were repentance. That's why I pointed this out. That the repentance that we think about is always a great big sackcloth and ashes and, oh, I'm sorry, kind of approach. And God doesn't look at that kind of thing. That's our dramatics that always puts that kind of thing into focus. There are just these smallest things that we are hardly aware of ourselves that are the opening up of the heart to the gospel again. And heaven knows it happens to us hundreds of times a day almost. It isn't just a once-in-a-lifetime thing. And it continues over and over and over again. And that's why we talk about the patience of God. Because he does have patience with us. He's continually seeking us and, you know, having these little tiny little, just the littlest bit of a flicker of an eyelid is enough for him to work on again. You know, it's not, you know, nobody is outside the pale of that. And all the way through here, Wentworth isn't, it's only because Wentworth really, really wanted to so badly, but it's like Dante says, no one, absolutely no one desires God who will not have him. Nothing in heaven and earth can stand in the way of that. And, you know.
But can't heaven and earth tempt you away from a desire for God?
Oh, well, you sure can. But, you know, if you still come back to that quite often. I mean, I've been lots of times without a desire for God. Quite lots, in fact. And you know, it's just the fact that the gospel is a continuous kind of force and energy in the universe that constantly is pulling you back to that. And there's no way that none of us is can be outside of that. Because otherwise, how could you say for the whole world? You know, how can you say John 3:16? Unless you understand that. See? I mean, you have to, it has to be that is for everybody. But, of course, as in Dante and the Inferno and in this one, you get very clearly stated that when you make up your mind over constant refusals, and these are not big dramatic refusals, these are little ethical decisions that you make along the way over 50 to 100 years maybe of living, that you know, then you really decide you'd rather live in hell. And in the Inferno is what that's about. That's the kind of living you get then. But you've chosen it. God didn't put you there. Any more than God puts you in heaven. You know, you do what you want to do. But you have the opportunity to be at the threshold of ascent at a number of times. I mean, you're not, you don't drop into hell like that. I got my fingers snapping.
Yay!
Well, anyway, you don't do that at one blow. The thing is, these are things that build up over a long period of time, usually. Very, very, I don't think it's ever possible to say that people just have one choice and that's it. Well,
and those little choices that we...
Well, the little choices that you make are the ones that don't
they
seem to be.
They are all forgiven.
And,
okay. Ooh. I don't know if this means or not, but what then does it mean, like in the Creed, when we say, and he shall come again to judge both the quick and the dead?
Mm-hmm.
How does that correspond that if God doesn't make the decision of sending us to hell or to hell, but we make the choice?
Well, the thing is that what judgment means, I mean, that's, nobody knows except that judgment can be the statement of where, what things are happening, you know, at a certain time. It doesn't necessarily mean sometimes people who think that they have not made that kind of decision have made it. You see what I mean? I mean, like when he says, oh, but but we, you know, we cast out demons in your name, and we talked about you, and we knew your name real well. And he says, I never knew you, you know. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Wentworth is he didn't know he was deciding for hell. He was just deciding for himself. He wanted to do what he wanted to do. It wasn't that he wasn't thinking about it as an absolute kind of a thing.
The last battle was really nice that way.
Yeah, the last battle was good.
The judgment is just whoever will see Aslan and wants to come in can, and everyone else who doesn't.
But I think we have to remember that even with the Narnia books, and with Williams, and with Dante, and with all these things, they are not, you know, you can't make doctrine out of them. They are all interpretations, they're all methods of discovery, mm-hmm. Ways in which you have to see things and see whether or not you may not, you know, this doesn't have to be, nobody, certainly not Lewis, and George MacDonald himself, you remember, in The Great Divorce says, be sure that these people, that ye don't confuse them and make them think this is the truth when it's just a story, you know. And that's really important to realize, that this is a story. And even Dante is a story. It's not, this isn't scripture, it isn't, you know, there's no revelation from God with a whole document of truths on it. So you have to remember that this is a way of interpreting things. And it's not talking about the last judgment, it's simply talking about the way we deal with our lives here and now, more than the future. Well, I suppose we're at the end of the hour again, 2 hours. I would like to have you just look at this doctrine of substituted love. I mean, what time is it? 12?
I got
12
after 11.
What?
I got
11:30. Oh, is that all? Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. Rondi has, she has to be down for to eat before she leaves, I guess. Page 91. It's interesting that you go from Eden, which is a rejection of the other, to the absolute opposite in chapter 6, which is the complete acceptance of the other and reception of the other. See, the doctrine of substituted love, where it's worked out actually how this burden carrying can take place. one thing I just want you to notice, and just in passing, on page 92, Stanhope talks about the and I think I mentioned it yesterday, about the fact that the speediness of the verse, that it was supposed to be quick and go rapidly. And this is kind of another similarity with the purgatory. The purgatory, Dante's purgatory, goes fast. And the importance is that they're all in a hurry to get through as fast as they can to get to heaven. And so even the verses themselves have a quick beat to them. And Stanhope, although he's not probably just on the same subject, but it's kind of a similar kind of a thing that struck me again when I read Dante and then read this after that, that speed was an element, and he would rather have the meaning lost than too firmly explained, and that speed was the important thing. Of course, there were people that thought that wasn't to be done, including Mrs. Perry, and she did it exactly the way she wanted to. On page 93, Pauline says, is thinking about what Peter Stanhope had said to her at the beginning. She herself had rather avoided him. It's about the middle of that paragraph. She herself had rather avoided him. She was not yet altogether prepared, in so many words, to accept the terror of good. And I think you have to underline that terror of good. You have to remember that this, and this comes in again, and it's absolutely true. Goodness is not, you know, meekness and sweetness and pat me on the back some more, but there is a terribleness about the good. there's another place where he talks about that on page 95. she's talking to Peter, and he says, why do you always look about you? What are you looking for? And she said, well, she knows, of course. And he says, there's nothing worth quite so much vigilance or anxiety. Watchfulness, but not anxiety, not fear. You let it into yourself when you fear it so. And whatever it is, it's less than your life. Don't let this fear govern you. And then she says, you talk as if life were good. That's either good or evil, he answered, and you can't decide that by counting incidents on your fingers. The decision is of another kind. You can think about that. The decision is of another kind. What makes life good is not, well, I've had this and this and this, but I haven't had this and this and this, so life is bad, so life is good. I mean, that's not where the decision comes as to whether life is good or not. Now you think about what that means. And then at the bottom of the page, he says, well, he said, if you think it sounds sillier, she says, tell me what bothers you. And she said, it sounds too silly. And then he stops and then he says, well, if you think it sounds sillier than that, and he's talking about the poetry and so on, God is good. If I hadn't been here, they might have done the tempest. Consider that. Well, then she goes on and finally decides that she can tell him what's happened. And then he says, she says, this is page 96, it'll come right up to me, and then I shall go mad or die. Why? He asked quickly, and she answered at once, because I'm afraid, dreadfully afraid. But, he said, that I don't quite understand. You have friends. Haven't you asked one of them to carry your fear? Carry my fear, she said, sitting rigid in her chair, so that her arms, which had lain so lightly, pressed now into the basket work. How can anyone else carry my fear? Can anyone else see it and have to meet it? Still in that public place, leaning back easily as if they talked of casual things. He said, you're mixing up two things. Now, I want you to catch the kind of mood. Here they're talking about life and death, the truths of the whole universe. And it's, you know, and it's two lawn chairs and, you know, it's not being done before an altar. It's not done in some, you know, confessional cell. It's done, you know, when everybody else was talking, we were practicing, and they were just sitting there, and Peter Stanhope doesn't make a big thing of it. He just says, well, this is the way it is. And I think you have to remember that this is very often the way the gospel comes through to all of us. It doesn't come necessarily in a sermon as being the only way it comes. It comes very often through a conversation that somebody has with us. Still in that public place, leaning back easily as if they talked of casual things, he said, you're mixing up two things. Think a moment, you'll see. The meeting it, that's one thing. And we can leave it till you're rid of the other. It's the fear we're talking about. Has no one ever relieved you of that? Haven't you ever asked them to? Well, you haven't understood, of course. I was a fool. Let's forget. Isn't Mrs. Perry efficient? Extremely, he answered, and God redeem her. But nicely. I think that's really neat. Redeem her, but nicely. Well, will you tell me whether you have any notion what I'm talking about? Well, of course she didn't. She said, do it for me? It can be done, you know. Surprisingly simple. There's no one else you care to ask. Why not use me? I'm here. Easily set up that way. You don't need fear at least. Well, as for the meeting, that might be a very different business if you weren't distressed. How can I not be afraid? And she goes on and talks about this. And then at the bottom of the page, she says, were great poets liars? No, but they might be mistaken. Yes, so might she. She said very doubtfully, but I don't understand. You haven't seen it. How can you? He indicated the rehearsal. Tommy said, if you like that, will you tell me that I must see in order to know? That's not pride. And if it were, it wouldn't matter. Listen, when you go from here, when you're alone, and you think you'll be afraid, let me put myself in your place and be afraid instead of you. And then he says, it's so easy. Well, it doesn't turn out to be all that easy, but because, remember, when those of you who read it, remember that Stanhope, you know, it's really quite a thing that when he takes this burden carrying into himself. But he says, well, you know, I know, it means listening sympathetically and thinking unselfishly, being anxious about, and so on. That's what people think about when they, you know, when they're going to be Christians to each other. No, I'll listen to you, you know. Sure, oh, that's too bad. I know, I know. Well, that isn't the same thing at all from what Peter Stanhope is talking about. Well, I don't say a word against all that. No doubt it helps. But I think when Christ or St. Paul or whoever said bear or whatever he Aramaically said instead of bear, he meant something much more like carrying a parcel instead of someone else. To bear a burden is precisely to carry it instead of. If you're still carrying yours, I'm not carrying it for you. However sympathetic I may be. And anyway, there's no need to introduce Christ unless you wish. You know, I mean, this is not a religious tract. Now, don't get nervous, people. You can read this without feeling like anybody's trying to convert you. That's what Williams is kind of saying to the reader. It's a fact of experience. If you give a weight to me, you can't carry it yourself. All I'm asking you to do is to notice that blazing truth. It doesn't sound very difficult. And if I could, would I push my burden onto anybody else? Not if you insist on making a universe for yourself, he answered. If you want to disobey and refuse the laws that are common to us all, if you want to live in pride and division and anger, you can. But if you will be part of the best of us and live and laugh and be ashamed with us. In other words, don't hold on to your damn self-respect all the time and your pride and always feel like, oh, I'm different and I have to do things myself. You must give your burden up to somebody and you must carry someone else's burden. I haven't made the universe, it's my fault, but I'm sure that this is a law of the universe, and not to give up your parcel is as much to rebel as not to carry another's. Now this is so important, because it's very hard for us to accept help from somebody else. It's much easier to help somebody. But believe me, if you have to accept help, it's another thing. You'll find it quite easy if you let yourself do it. And what of my self-respect, she said. He laughed at her with a tender mockery. Oh, if you're of that kind, if you want to respect yourself, if to respect yourself you must go clean against the nature of things, if you must refuse the omnipotence in order to respect yourself, though why you should want so extremely to respect yourself is more than I can guess, but go on and respect. Must I apologize for suggesting anything else? So then he says, well, now remember, when you're alone, that I have taken it. And if you don't see your doppelganger, well, okay. But if you do, you won't be afraid. And since you're not afraid, she said, I can't imagine not being afraid. Well, you're going to leave it to me? Will you please remember that? Absolutely. I'm to remember. She almost broke into a little laugh. Then you're being worried and terrified instead of me? I've taken it over. And if I see it? Not after all, he said. The fact remains, but see how different a fact if it can't be dreaded. But you see, I mean, that makes a big difference. You know, if something is terrible, but you're not afraid of it, you know, I discovered that in prison camp, that having a fear, I wasn't afraid of anything anymore, not even reading detective stories, because, you know, everything, all the things that I would be afraid of had already been taken over by a greater fear. And so you can lose a fear of fear of fear. And of course, as Roosevelt said, all we have to fear is fear. But that, and he was simply reiterating what's being said right here, that fear is something that it's a terrible thing, because it doesn't have any real concretion to it. It's something we build up more and more in ourselves. And he says, well, ring me up tonight about 9 and tell me if you're being obedient to the whole fixed nature of things. I'll ring up, she said. It sounds so silly. It is silly. Sooth and dallies with the innocence of love. Real sooth, real innocence, real love. Go with God. She shook hands and slowly, looking back once, just before she reached the lane, she went out of sight. Now, this next part here, I want you to notice it, because he's still looking at the rehearsal. But he is also concentrating on Pauline at the same time. He recollected Pauline. He visualized her going along a road, any road. He visualized another Pauline coming to meet her. And as he did so, his mind contemplated not the first, but the second Pauline. He took trouble to apprehend the vision. He summoned through all his sensations an approaching fear. Deliberately, he opened himself to that fear, laying aside for a while every thought of why he was doing it, forgetting every principle and law, absorbing only the strangeness and the terror of that separate spiritual identity. His more active mind reflected it in an imagination of himself going into his house and seeing himself, but he dismissed that, for he desired to subdue himself not to his own natural sensation but to hers first, and let hers, if so it should happen, be drawn back into his own. But it was necessary first intensely to receive all her spirit's conflict. He sat on, imagining to himself the long walk with its sinister possibility, the ogreish world lying around, the air with its treachery to all sane appearance. His own eyes began to seek and strain and shrink. His own feet, quiet though actually they were, began to weaken with the necessity of advance upon the road down which the girl was passing. The body of his flesh received her in terror. His mind carried the burden of her world. The burden was inevitably lighter for him than for her, for the rage of a personal resentment was lacking. He endured her sensitiveness, but not her sin. The substitution there, if indeed there is a substitution, is hidden in the central mystery of Christendom, which Christendom itself has never understood, nor can. Kind of neat. But we really never understand this whole substitution. We don't understand Christ substituting for us, and we don't understand how we substitute for each other. Now, this law of exchange, I don't know very many people that have done this, you know. I don't really know that how many of us can. But it is a great thought and a great possibility of actually, we've done some things like that up here. After I talked about this one year, I talked about it from his image of the city, and there were some things that, for instance, if one girl was really tired of praying about something, she had prayed and prayed and prayed, and she was really fed up with praying about it. And she asked me if I'd pray for it for all. It had nothing really to do with me. But she said, I prayed myself out of faith. I can't even believe it anymore, that it's possible for anything to happen. And so I took over her praying for a while on that particular thing. I mean, now that was not, except that it's a lot of work for me to remember to pray. I mean, as I'm not very disciplined, but that was one thing, and when I prayed for it, I actually had to pray with imagination over against why she needed this and what was so important about it, and tried to enter into it to pray for it somewhat as she would pray about it with the same kind of insistence. But I've never tried anything like this. But I think it's something that we don't know what we could do if we bore one another's burdens in actuality. I really don't think we have ever really tried all the possibilities of Christendom. And then he says something down here on page 101, the middle of that. The experience itself, sharply as his body took it, was less sharp for him. Not that he willed it so, but because his senses received their communication from within, not from without. And there is in all holy imagination, from goodwill, a quality of greatness which purifies and stabilizes experience. His goodwill went to its utmost, and utmost goodwill can go very far. That really is that's a very good paragraph there on page 101, and I think you might like to go back and read it over again yourselves. And as you remember, she was able to make it without the fear. She couldn't believe it that she didn't, you know. And she called him up and she says on page 104, because she'd looked at a kitten on a wall. Just think, she'd never been able to stop and enjoy anything. She'd never been able to smell the flowers. There was a kitten on a wall. She never been able to look at a kitten or anything else that was on, because she was so busy trying to get home before she met this person again. And so all of a sudden she could enjoy life. And on page 104 she says, she calls him up and she said, well, there was a kitten and pinks and a pattern for a frog and a postman who said the rain was holding off. Cautious man, said Stanhope, and waited. Well, that was all. Really all, Stanhope asked. Really all, she said. I just went home. It is real, I suppose. Entirely, said Stanhope. Aren't you sure of it? Yes, yes, yes. I want to thank you. I don't know what you did. I told you. But I did want to thank you. Only what happens now? I mean, do I should think you did, don't you? It seems a perfectly good idea. But you don't mean that, you protested. It looks so like taking advantage. You'd be as involved morally as you are verbally if you talk like that, she said. Taking advantage, oh, my dear girl, don't be so silly. You've got your own job to do. What's that, she asked. Being ready to meet it, he answered. It'll be quite simple, no doubt, and even delightful, but if I were you, I'd keep my faculties quiet for that. If meeting is a pleasure, as we so often tell people, you may as well enjoy the pleasure. I hadn't really thought of it being that before. But now, he asked. Yeah, I suppose it might, she said. Same reason, whatever I choose, since we're agreed you won't have any opportunity to be afraid. Funny. Jim, I feel as if I'd never looked at it till now. At least, perhaps the first time when I was quite small, but... And then she goes on and explains it, an experience she'd had as a child and her sense of sin and about it. And then, he says down here, on page 106, she says, toward the bottom of the page, he says at the end of the conversation, go in peace and wish me the same for friendship's sake. Oh, how can I, she said, startled. How can I wish peace to you? You are peace. Stanhope said. But the more if you will have it so, try. Good night, then, she answered slowly. Good night, thank you. Go in peace. Her voice had faltered so she could hardly speak the words. And when she rose, she was on fire from head to foot. She was so embarrassed for saying it. You see, she had to say it, and I think we talked about that a little bit yesterday. Down in the middle of page 107, you get a hint of what's going to happen because the line from George Fox's Martyrs comes to her of John Strother. I have seen the salvation of my God. They set him to the stake and put the fire to the wood. And as the fire got hold of him, he gave a great cry and said, I have seen the salvation of my God. The Lord had done great things for him there in the midst of the fire. The Lord, she thought, made a habit of doing things in the midst of a fire. He had just brought her to say, go in peace, in another. She glowed again to think of it. But it was the first phrase she had looked for. I have seen the salvation. Never occurred to her, any time she'd read and remembered the martyrdom, that Strother was anything but a demented fanatic, a faint distaste that she should come of his blood, had touched her. It now occurred to her that Strother might have been talking flat realism. She put the book down, looked out the window. It was all of a sudden remarkably easy to look out of the window. She might even walk down the gate and look at the street. The parcel was completely in someone else's care, and all she had to do was leave it. She hoped it wasn't troublesome. But it wouldn't be. He and whatever he meant by the omnipotence would manage it quite well between them. Perhaps later on she could give the omnipotence a hand with some other burden. Everyone carrying everyone else's, like the silly islanders taking each other's washing. And you know, that's true of people that, you know, like people always, well, you boys, I don't know if you ever had to do this, but a lot of times you hear women say, oh, I don't mind doing dishes at somebody else's house. You know, it's always fun to do somebody else's dishes. I mean, I don't know whether they say that because they really mean it, but I think it's true because I don't mind doing it at somebody else's house as much as I do doing my own. And this is what she's talking about, that it's somehow, there's a different thing about doing another person's job than your own. Then you see this, Lily is back again on the bottom of page 108. Lily comes in, isn't it a lovely night? I haven't seen you lately. You haven't wanted to see me. I thought perhaps you might. Pauline looked back, smiling. How in this quietness of spirit could she have thought she wanted anything changed? But the young lady had wanted to help, and though now she didn't need the help, the good will remain. She said, oh, much better now. That's good, the other one said, but take care of yourself. Think of yourself. Be careful of yourself. I could make you perfectly safe and perfectly happy at the same time. You really haven't any idea of how happy you could be. Her voice was definitely softer. Yeah. And Pauline could remember it. In the full light of day, the other woman seemed to her slightly hard, her voice a light third hammer to her feet. She pattered everywhere, upstairs, downstairs, in my lady's chamber. But now her figure was dim and her feet still and her voice soft. As soft as the dust the evening wind was blowing down the street, dust of the dead, dust of the Strother who had died in flame. Had he been happy, happy, happy? Pauline was not sure whether she or her companion had spoken the word again, but it hung in the air. She said as if to draw down the floating mist, happy, I happy. The other man had happy, rich, insatiate, yet satisfied how delicious everything would be. Could tell you a tale that would shut everything but yourself out. Wouldn't you like to be happy? If there's anything that worries you, I can shut it away from you. Think what you might be missing. Well, she goes on, and then Pauline has this sudden reversal, and she kind of wishes, oh, I wish I hadn't gotten involved with Stanhope. You know, this kind of sounds good to me. And she says, come soon, come now, I'll wait for this at 1:10. I'll wait for you here. In a few minutes you'll be free, and then you'll come. You should be back soon. Give me your hand. I'll give you a foretaste now. A hand came into hers, a pulse against her wrist beat with significance of breathless abandon to delirious joy. She delayed in a tremulous and pleasurable longing. And this is the kind of thing that happened to Paola and Francesca. Remember, I said it was the playing with the sin that was wrong. It was the dallying around with the idea of it that was bad. But how, she murmured, how can all this happen? How do I know what I want? I've never thought, I don't know anyone, and to be alone. Give me your hand, the other said, then come and dream till you discover so soon the rightness of your dreams. You never have to do anything for others anymore. That's a really, was the last touch, and false because the habit of her past and because of Stanhope's promise, the fountain of beauty had sprung upward in a last thrust. It broke against the arched roof of his world, and the shock stung her into coldness. Never have to do anything, and she had been promising herself that she would carry someone's parcel as hers had been carried, that she would be what he said she could. Like it or not, it had been an oath. Rash or wise, it stood. An oath, I have an oath in heaven. She'd been reading more verse of late, so she started saying it that way. But anyway, then all the way down here in this whole page, you realize this is a real battle that's going on in her soul for her position as a person who's going to be a burden bearer for somebody else. Because she has this chance now to be, oh, I can just live for myself again. And then the grandmother calls her. And that call by the maid is what turns her. And instead of saying to the maid, well, I'll be in after a while, she turns immediately and says, you wanted me? Phoebe murmured, your grandmother's asking for you, Miss Pauline, if you could come. Pauline said, I'm coming. She looked over the gate, and she added in a voice hard with an unreasoning hostility, good night. And she ran in. I mean, there's a real cutoff there with... And then this next one, the next chapter on the travelers, I think you can go over that, read that yourselves. The dress rehearsal is is exciting from the point of view of the fact that this is the time that Wentworth has a chance to make another change. Remember, he could change the costumes, and he doesn't. And he sees Adela, and this, he thought this would bother him, but it didn't. He wasn't interested in her anymore. And the whole thing is part of the experience. And and then during the dress rehearsal, I think you remember there comes the possibility of what's going to happen to Pauline. But as this book proceeds, and I think you can finish the rest of it, because the rest of it is enough so that it's really exciting enough to read by yourself, certainly, and I feel that I've dried it up enough with all this explanation. But I hope you'll watch for all these, the kind of things we've been looking at through the book, because they really make the book more exciting when you read it for yourself. I don't think it helps it in discussion like this, but I think that when you do your own reading, you'll find that it's a real joy. There was one thing I wanted to, I especially wanted to read to you, but I can't remember where it is. It's a place where he talks about, where he's talking about the terrible good. And he says, remember that the substantive governs the adjective. And I always notice little grammatical things like that. Do you know what a substantive is? It's a noun. And if I say the terrible good, what is the noun and what is the adjective?
Good is the noun.
Good is the noun, and the adjective is terrible. if he says that the noun governs the adjective, what does that mean? What does it mean? Somebody else now, Chris. You did say something, and there was something over here. Now somebody else say something. What does it mean if you say the noun governs the adjective?
The adjective could be like a part of the noun.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the noun.
Exactly. The noun isn't part of the adjective. Yeah. And it also means that what about the it governs what about that adjective? I mean the noun is good. So the terribleness is a good kind of terribleness, right? See, it's not terrible from the point of view of a terrible storm that is a disaster to everybody, but it has a kind of quality that strikes a kind of terror in you, but it's a good kind of terror. It's what we learn in the catechism when we say, what's that one? We should fear and love and trust in God above all things. Fear is something that you lots of times don't think of in terms of loving. But fear and love are together, and don't forget it. That fear and love go together when it refers, especially when it's a relationship with God. And that's why you can say the terrible good, because it's an awe-filling thing to be related to that kind of goodness. And what you deal with in the omnipotence here and in Williams is not something to play with. It's a great and terrible truth. But the goodness is what makes it the way it is, not the terror of it. Goodness is the center of it. But it's not a wishy-washy, soft, you know, blah kind of goodness. It's a goodness that inspires fear as well as love, and terror as well as comfort. So that's the kind of God that is portrayed in all of Williams's books, and certainly in the Narnia books, and in the Dante, and in most books that are worth their salt, as where the writers have been Christians. They have that kind of quality in them. Well, tomorrow I'd like to have you be sure to have some part of Dante that you think would be, and you don't, if you really feel, really don't want to say anything, or you don't want to read anything, you know, this isn't a forced thing. I don't believe in that. But if you felt that you could be moved to read a few lines, it would be fine. Or if you want to read something from the commentary, that's all right too. But let's just pool our information tomorrow and see what we've got.
Are we not going to talk about the sermon?
Well, if you have any questions, we can.
I didn't understand what happened to Adele.
Well, I can talk to you about that. I'll talk about that if there's time tomorrow. But we can't. The one thing, as I say, the one thing that I dislike about going through this one so carefully, but that you've got a lot of other Williams books that you can find out about yourselves. That I hate to answer all the questions, just like I hate the fact that preachers have preached on all the parables, so we never think about anything that Jesus said anymore. And everything's been explained, and that's, you know, you sort of feel like that when you over-explain something, there's not enough left for the person who's doing the reading. So, but I think there are plenty of books for you to read and where you have to use your own imagination, even in the Williams corpus. So, I don't worry about that too much. So if there are questions on the descent into hell that you'd like to ask about tomorrow, we can take time for that. And we may possibly have time to I might just show you a little bit about what he talks about in the image of the city, because I think he's got a tremendous concept of what the city is, and especially when you live in the wilderness.